This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Tax reform is set to pass the North Carolina House today. The measure reduces personal and corporate income tax while raising sales taxes and expanding its reach. A family making $250,000 a year can expect a cut of about $1,700. That same family, if it makes $1 million, could be looking at a $12,000 reduction. On the other hand, a family making only $40,000 a year would get about $40. Republicans say tax cuts put more money into the economy. Democrats point out that taxes are not lost to local businesses. They are spent back into the economy and counter that, in fact, it's tax cuts that lose and are lost to the system, since much of the savings for wealthy families goes to financial investments. Much of that finds its way to foreign shores. Joining us now to talk about this, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen on the program. Rob Christensen, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Glad to be here.
So let's talk about this tax reform. Here's the one thing everybody agrees on. It is long overdue in the state of North Carolina, right? No debate about that.
It hasn't. Our basic tax structure was set in the 1930s during the Depression. So both Republicans and Democrats agree that the system is antiquated and needs to be overhauled. Further, I think if there was one thing that came out of this election, which the Republicans won, both the governorship and the legislature, is that there was a consensus among the Republicans that the corporate income tax and the individual income tax needed to be brought down and brought more in line with other southeastern states. So we started the legislative session with a consensus among all the major players, which are Republicans now, to bring that down. The question is, how do you do that? And that's a very, very tricky thing, because even if there's an agreement on how you bring it down, there was also agreement to make it fair as revenue neutral as possible. Therefore, you know, you're not trying to raise taxes, you're not trying to lower taxes, you're trying to change it to make it more more competitive with other states and make the state more economically competitive. But the problem is, to do that, even if you're lowering taxes on somebody, if you're making it revenue neutral, you got to raise it on somebody else. And so you've had various competing plans. You had the Senate. We're talking about raising sales taxes and so forth. And those are very difficult taxes to raise. Now, if anybody knows a little bit about history, in the 1960s, the community college system was basically financed by Governor Terry Sanford pushing through the sales tax. That was a black cloud over Terry Sanford for the rest of his political career. They called him Food Tax Terry, because that's a tax you pay every time you go to buy a candy bar. And so the Republicans...
Well, that's a regressive tax.
It's a regressive tax.
It affects poor people, low-income people, the same as wealthy.
And you pay it, time and time and time again.
Right.
And so the Republicans were very, very leery about this, because they understood that this is a tax that could be very toxic. So they've been wrestling with, and because it's a very dangerous issue for them. They like the idea of lowering the income tax and the corporate tax, but they're very leery of raising things like the sales tax, particularly on things like Social Security exemption, because who votes? Old people vote, right? Sales tax, you know, that's a tax that they do not want to see in the next election. This is bumper stickers: is Republicans raised your sales tax or the food tax? So you have competing plans. The governor seems to be very much lining up with the House plan, which doesn't seem to go as far as the Senate plan in terms of sales tax. And so we're going to come out of this process. We're going to see what comes out. But right now, Republicans are finding that whole taxes is a very, very difficult thing, which is why it hasn't been changed in the 1930s.
When you talk about the politics of this, it's kind of interesting, because if you look at the last election, for instance, I think we know that more people actually voted. There were more votes for Democrats overall, statewide, than Republicans, but because of the way the districts are structured.
Well, that's not true for the legislative races. That's true for congressional races. Actually, the more people did vote Republican in legislative races, but by a very small margin, not by the margin that we see in actual numbers in the legislature.
I wonder if the governor has to be any more sensitive to that fact than lawmakers when it comes to deciding which package to back.
Well, I think that there are political differences. First of all, I think the governor, you know, there's a great degree of differences among Republicans. Some of them are more moderate business Republicans, Chamber of Commerce Republicans. Others are more conservative. So they don't march lockstep. I think Governor McCrory is a more traditional Chamber of Commerce Republican, and he doesn't. He is not the kind of sharp conservative that we have among some legislators, and so they come from different places politically and ideologically, and so and he gets elected statewide, and he got elected with a lot of independent voters. Got elected with some Democratic voters. A lot of legislators came from very conservative districts, and they don't have to be concerned so much about independent voters.
Talking today about what's going on in the legislature at the moment, talking about tax reform. Want to bring in a few more people right now. Joining us in the studio, Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Jed Purdy's with us as well. He's a professor of law at Duke University. Welcome to both of you. Good day.
Thank you.
Thanks, Frank.
Becky, let me talk with you about this, the tax plan in general. Now, I know there are several plans, but the idea in general to lower corporate and personal income taxes before we talk about raising sales tax, because that's still on the table. Is that a good idea and why?
I think it's a great idea. And also, let me address the sales tax for just a minute, if you will. Really, they're not raising the sales tax rate. They are lowering the sales tax. They are extending the sales tax to more taxpayers, if you will. Generally, in both the plans that we've seen that are moving forward, the Senate plan and the House plan, they extend that to services that have never been tax collectors for state government before. So really what both of these plans do, and the Republicans ran on this, I don't think this should come as any surprise to anybody, that they would lower the corporate tax, lower the personal income tax, flatten it, which is in both of these plans as well, and lower the sales tax rate. And extend that to more taxpayers.
But it also includes food, in some cases medicine as well.
Well, in the Senate plan, it does. It does not in the House plan,
right,
which I believe is why the House plan is moving forward. It's a little more palatable. It's not as aggressive as the Senate plan for those very reasons that you outlined. It doesn't tax food. It doesn't tax Social Security benefits. It doesn't tax many other things. It's a little more moderate plan. And that's the one that's moving forward. As a matter of fact, is being debated as we're talking here,
right.
I believe they're in downtown Raleigh talking about the House tax plan.
What is good about that? Why lower taxes at all in these times? Why do that?
Well, the key to getting our economy moving again has got to be a piece of this. And I want to emphasize that tax reform alone is not going to get the economy moving, but it is a big piece of getting the economy moving. To get our tax rates competitive with other states, we have about the highest tax rates when you combine everything and look at it. You know, it's a menu of things. But our tax rates are not competitive across the country and not even with our immediate neighbors. So we're at a disadvantage there when recruiting businesses.
But let me ask you, if that's really playing out. You know, we talked about this last week, the state with the ninth lowest tax rate in the country and no personal income taxes, Nevada, and it has the highest unemployment rate. So is there a real correlation, a hard and fast correlation between business competitiveness and tax rates?
I think there is. But again, to that point, you also have to take other things into consideration. Every state has a different menu of taxes that they put together. Some states with no personal income tax have very, very high property tax rates, which may affect business decisions in different ways. So I think what the intent is of this General Assembly and this administration is to get our rates lower than anybody else, or certainly our competitors, if you will, along with looking at government regulations, the burden that government puts on businesses, as well as many other factors. We're seeing substantive education reform and other things that are being looked at, tax cuts. Rob mentioned revenue neutral. Both of these plans that are being considered by the General Assembly are actually tax cuts. So you're looking at a less burdensome government, less government, getting government out of the way in numerous ways in order to move the economy forward. And tax reform is a piece of that.
Well, I did see, though, I think the House plan, right, leaves you $302 million short in the first year. Is it? No, that's the Senate plan. That's the Senate plan. Forgive me. I think the Senate plan is not revenue neutral.
Nor is the House plan. Yes, yeah. I understand it. And, you know, these numbers are changing almost hourly as they're making tweaks to it. But I think it's about a $750 million tax cut in the Senate plan over 2 years, and about half that is what we're seeing in the House plan. So again, this is a tax cut with the intent of getting that money back into the hands of the people who earned it, getting money back into the hands of businesses so that they can expand, create jobs, hire an extra worker, buy another truck to get their businesses moving again.
Jed Purdy, is that what actually happens to money? Because we're talking about at the higher end, far more money in the hands of people who are wealthy than, say, somebody making 40 grand a year. year. So is that what happens to that money? Does it stay in your local community if I get more of it?
Well, here are a few things we need to think about. Let's start with that question. Assuming that what we want to do with the tax code is increase economic growth, there is a question about whether putting more money in the hands of the wealthy potential investors is going to translate into local investment and local job creation. If that's part of the theory, it may not be entirely suited to the 21st century. It's clearly true that in the 80s, even in the 90s, in the mid-20th century, you basically had national capital pools. And if people shifted money from consumption to investment, the investment would probably be here in the States. Since capital deregulation, global capital deregulation in the 90s, along with other developments, we clearly have a global capital pool. So money that's invested in some cases, local business owners, sure, will use the marginal dollar to buy new capital or create a new job. But generic investment by wealthy folks doesn't necessarily stay in North Carolina or even in the U.S. It goes offshore through global capital flows. It ends up subsidizing research on clean energy in China or building dams in China. So that complicates it. There's a second thing to think about from the point of view of economic growth, which is that a lot of recent work by macroeconomists, including Nobel Prize winners like Joe Stiglitz, suggests that inequality is actually bad past a point for economic development. So to the extent we're talking about a regressive shift in the tax burden, we have to ask how that's going to play out in the long run.
On the State of Things Today, we'll talk more about that and other initiatives in the North Carolina legislature with my guest, Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at John Locke Foundation, Duke Law Professor Jed Purdy, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen. The conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking with our news roundtable about tax reform and a variety of other news items this week. With us, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen, Duke Law Professor Jed Purdy, and Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach at the John Locke Foundation. Jed, I want to move on to some other topics now and talk about one that may not have gotten a lot of attention, but a fairly interesting bill. It's being called the Ag Gag Bill, and it appeared in the Senate last week. Essentially, it prevents people from lying on their applications or using other kinds of fraudulent means to get a job at a livestock factory with the purpose of investigating mistreatment of animals or other mistreatment or abuses in that plant. And it's model legislation. Before we get to sort of it's model legislation provided by a group called ALEC. So let's talk about ALEC and how this legislation is making its way across the country.
So ALEC, which is the American Legislative Exchange Committee, is a conservative clearinghouse that produces model legislation on a variety of topics, which then gets picked up and tweaked or rewritten for introduction in state legislatures. There are liberal analogs to this. It's a sort of common form of trying to spread your style of reform from state to state. So these ag gag laws have been part of ALEC's menu since about 2000, 2001, I think.
All right. And what would this do? Because, in fact, you did this. You snuck into a slaughterhouse yourself.
I did. I snuck into a slaughterhouse back in the late 90s with a little help from some rebellious employees and spent some time on a killing room floor in eastern Colorado. So what would it do? It would make criminals, and the penalty would be, I think, in the North Carolina version, heavy fines, not jail time. And it doesn't include some of the other sort of striking things in the ALEC model legislation, like the creation of an eco-terrorist list for anyone who violates this law. That's not part of the North Carolina proposal. It would make you a criminal if you do something. I mean, how shall we put it? If you do something that there's a long and significant tradition of doing, right, which is going underground to expose abuses within industries that in some ways can't be fully appreciated unless you're able to go inside and make them vivid. I mean, we may know in the abstract what it looks like inside a slaughterhouse, but it's a different kind of information when you have camera phone images, when you have the kinds of that's our 21st century version of the kinds of detailed descriptions of the meat industry that Upton Sinclair created in his classic, The Jungle. I don't think ag gag laws are incomprehensible. I think it's quite right that companies have an interest in knowing what's going on the killing floor, which is a dangerous place, and they have an interest in knowing what their employees are up to. as well. At the same time, there's a very significant public interest in knowing what's going on in these facilities, both in cases where there may be lawbreaking, and there have been important instances in North Carolina of these kind of underground investigations revealing either abuse of animal welfare laws or violation of food safety laws. People also have an interest just in knowing what's going on in these places because, as a culture, we're divided about how we should treat animals, what we owe them, what it means that we kill them for our convenience. And the images of what goes on in there are kind of important information. So my view is that if we took seriously the reasons to limit potentially dangerous, irregular underground investigations, then we should ask the meat industry to give something back, which would be to accept installing webcams at key places in slaughterhouse facilities and let people, as part of the packaging on their meat, take a look inside the facility and see how it was processed.
Well, I wonder, Rob Christensen, sort of what effect you think this might have on journalism in general. I mean, as a reporter and as a columnist, this kind of legislation, what impact do you think it might have?
Well, this legislation, as Jed noted, has been introduced in various legislatures, and I think in Tennessee, the governor vetoed it because it does raise constitutional issues of freedom of the press, whether journalists can in fact do their job. And in fact, there were some issues here about one of the networks did an investigation involving Food Lion. It wasn't a meat packing, mm-hmm. but it was whether meat spoilage issue, I think, was involved here.
Right, right. It's a food safety question.
Yeah, so it does raise those kinds of those questions. Of course, you raise some issues that people really don't want to make me really want to see where right. How their food actually is produced. They think of their meat as coming from Harris Teeter as opposed to coming from the farm. But it's a tough issue for legislators because, for one thing, Humane Society has been fighting back politically. They've been running some ads, and the ads have been pretty graphic. And when you see some of these graphic depictions of how these animals have the abuse these animals have, I mean, we hope these animals are killed in a humane kind of way and put together put to death humanely. But when you see some of these film video footage, it's quite disturbing to most people, I think, and so it's a really tough issue for these legislators, and it's been a tough issue for the industry to push these bills through legislature. It's not been a slam dunk.
It's not just humane treatment of animals, though. We're talking about worker safety. We're talking about food safety and the implications for other industries. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, it is fraud. I mean, if you go in under false pretenses, mm-hmm. you know, we have very strong ideas about not presenting yourself under fraudulent circumstances. And that seems to be something we should consider, too. But, Becky, I wonder how you feel about this legislation.
Well, Frank, I think you brought the real issue to front. First of all, although it's been called the ag-gag bill, and we've seen this in other states, it doesn't just apply to the farming industry.
Right.
We've gotten a lot of attention here in North Carolina after the Rayford farm and the treatment of the turkeys and all
Butter
of that.
Bar, yeah.
But it is not limited to food services or agriculture businesses or anything else. So just envision, if you would, panelists here have described in a food industry. Imagine, if you would, like in a high tech company. You know, should there be a law that an employee with the intent of coming into your business to videotape or photograph classified information that is very sensitive to your business, should they be allowed to do that? The business community, the North Carolina Chamber of Commerce, has come out in favor of this bill. It currently sits in the Senate House Rules Committee. It seems to have hit a wall, and I think it's very much for some of the points that have been brought today. I think there's some unintended consequences that need to be sorted out, and the very least of which is describe intent and how do you define intent as an applicant for a job. What is your intent when you go in to do that? I think that constitutionally and just from a legal question, how do you define intent? How do you figure that out? And is that different from a regular employee of a company who did not come in with the intent but found circumstances, whether it's in the agriculture industry or the high-tech industry or anywhere else, that warrants whistleblower action, if you will? It goes back to the intent. So there's some very gray areas in this that I believe need to be looked at before we move forward to it. And I think that's why that bill's sitting in the Senate Rules Committee, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and particularly when it comes to whether or not you go in with the intention of somehow enriching yourself. In other words, does this have a benefit for you? You're going to sell the intelligence to somebody who could use it, or whether there's a public good that would come out of it. That seems to be somehow pretty difficult thing to define legally, but something I think they ought to be wrestling with.
If I might, just quickly, that's why we have fraud actions. I mean, respectfully, this is not the first time anyone has noticed this problem. So if an employee lies to get a job for personal enrichment, that employee is subject to a fraud action. Difference between that and this law is that the company has to show enrichment of the employee and it has to show economic harm to itself. So the only thing that this adds to long-standing existing protection of trade secrets and against fraud is that it extends the net broadly enough to capture people who are doing undercover work without any personal gain.
That may have a public
good. Right. Yeah, that was just going to be my question, is that one of the things that we've looked at is, are our current laws that are in place, do they cover this kind of thing adequately? And perhaps we need to go back and look at existing law and tweak that a little bit rather than bring comprehensive reform.
Let's talk about fracking. Rob, what's going on with that? A lot of details still need to be worked out before the state finally goes ahead with exploration for fracking. Where are we right now in the fracking conversation?
Well, I really haven't followed that real closely, but the legislation does seem to be moving forward. I think it's going to be a really long time before we see fracking, but I think the legislature's intent to making sure that the state is in a position to move forward is more quickly than it originally intended. I think the moratorium seems to be being put aside, and they want to move forward. The question is whether the economics are there, and whether the industry is actually interested in moving in North Carolina this quickly.
Will they do it? Jed, is fracking continues to make its way through the General Assembly, and again, there are a number of bills still up in the air, but the moratorium does seem to be lifted, that's imminent. Should we be concerned, or should we just allow this to go forward? As Rob said, you know, natural gas companies just might not be interested in North Carolina anyway.
Might be. There are sort of two levels, I think. One is the latest version of the legislation coming through the House from the point of view of making a law that makes sense is a little bit of a cluster puddle, as they are authorizing issuance of permits for fracking beginning in 2015. Those permits would come out to drilling companies, drillers. This would be in advance of the legislature actually taking the action that's required under the law to lift the moratorium formally and let drilling begin. So you might be getting permits that don't actually let anyone do anything yet, and for which there's not actually legislation that'll give guidelines to make clear what the content of the permits has to be. So it's not clear whether we're not putting the cart well out in front of the horse, just as a matter of making a regulatory system that makes some kind of sense if we're going to have fracking. We're doing it in a pretty sloppy, choppy way right now. I think in the broader sense, fracking is really about what we're doing in the age of climate change. Are we entering an era of extreme fossil fuel extraction, where basically we're going to be going from technology to technology, finding the next way to get fossil fuel out of the ground before we finally make a market-driven transition, an unavoidable transition to sustainable fuels, or are we going to invest in renewables now? And from the point of view of North Carolina, that's sort of the question about, are we the Gulf Coast in Louisiana, or are we California? And I think embracing fracking.
Draw that distinction more clearly. What do you mean? Are we the Gulf Coast or California?
That is, are we going to do everything we can to make ourselves an extraction site, make ourselves a drilling site, put ourselves in the center of the current chapter of extreme fossil fuel extraction? Or are we going to try to put ourselves out in front in the future and trying to speed the coming of the future of a renewable energy economy?
So you make two points, and I want to talk with both of them. We'll talk with Becky about both. But first, cluster puddle. Nicely done. Nicely done. Hadn't heard that before. Becky, to the first point, are we putting the cart before the horse? Should we have a better idea of the impact of fracking? Because that's, I think, what we hear from all quarters. We just don't know exactly. That some of the evidence, the anecdotal stuff, has been outlier, and we don't know exactly what the impact is. On the other hand, since we don't know, maybe we should wait and learn more before we begin to issue permits. Are we moving too fast?
I don't think so. And I think, too, that this is a good example of we can, in fact, walk and chew gum at the same time. While the General Assembly is considering these things, the Mining and Energy Commission is meeting on a regular basis. And just full disclosure, I serve on a study committee under the Mining and Energy Commission that looks at local government issues. But the Mining and Energy Commission is meeting regularly. As a matter of fact, they're meeting today to look at this, to study it, to look at what not only other states are doing, but what other countries are doing. There is a comprehensive look at these things. Meanwhile, while this is going on, the General Assembly is looking at putting some measures in place to offer some certainty to industry. These are big investments that need to be made if, in fact, the industry chooses to come to North Carolina. And so what they're trying to do is, while the Mining and Energy Commission is further exploring these issues of, is it safe? Is it environmentally okay? What do we need to do to make it friendly to the environment and also friendly to industry? All of those kind of issues are being addressed. Financial interests are being considered as well. In the meantime, the legislature is setting up a schedule, if you will. And so the Mining and Energy Commission final report with all of these studies is due, I believe it's in October. What this legislation would do would say, given that we're expecting this report in October, and let's assume that we're going to get a good report or at least know where we are, then in March, we will begin to issue permits. But what this bill does, and it has been tweaked and perfected in many ways, I think, what it does is even these permits that will be issued in March have to have legislative approval. So it all goes back to the legislature to authorize this. And in the meantime, keeping an eye on all of these different pieces that are moving. The bill also, this bill that is was passed in the House today, as a matter of fact, will go back over to the Senate for another vote, but it increases the funding for local governments if there are damages to roads or other things that would mitigate those damages at local governments. Governments would then have the money or the funds to pay for those kind of things. So they're looking at all of the different angles. Are they looking at every single possibility? I think they're looking at everything that they can get to right now, and in the meantime, moving forward with it, but very cautiously. So I don't believe that they're moving too quickly.
But on that very point of the Mining Commission, we had Victor Rao, who's a member of that commission, on the show, and he said, we raised the question of the proprietary chemicals that are used in the fluid. And he said, oh, no, we've already agreed on that, and we're going to take the vote, but we're agreed that we are going to make full disclosure one of the qualifications for going ahead with fracking. And the commission was there, but the commission chair, after a meeting with Halliburton, said, we're going to table that. It won't happen. And so even the majority of the commission that wanted full disclosure, that idea was scuttled at the commission level before it even got to the legislature. And I wonder if there's a question of confidence at this point.
Well, I think, to your point, what's good about this, and Rob could certainly speak to this, but I think those kind of discussions are good, and that the commission's findings and the arguments and the things that they're going back and forth on, that they're discussed on this show, that Rob writes about it, that people know about it. I think what the result of that is they've taken that issue back and they're looking at it. So I think the openness and the full disclosure makes for a better commission, makes for a better study, makes for a better end result of the rules when we see those come out.
I've only got about a minute and a half left, but I want to talk about Moral Monday. There are growing more and more arrests, the attention by those who are clearly in opposition to what's going on at the legislature is getting more and more attention. Jed, you attended Moral Mondays, mm-hmm. And there's a big question about, the effectiveness of this. What's the point of all of this? And I just wonder what your sense of it is, having visited and given some thought to this.
Well, I think it's been very impressive, for one thing. I think efficiency is a great virtue in a social movement, and what I've seen has been carried off very, very well. I also think it's Governor McCrory made some remarks the other day about the distinction between appropriate civil disobedience and interference with government. I actually think they've struck a very delicate and appropriate line on both sides. Because civil disobedience is really part of the bargain a civilized society makes with itself, that if you want to raise the stakes of an issue, you don't shut down the government as a political minority, you don't invade the legislative chamber, but you put your body on the line, you let yourself be taken to jail for a time, you let it be known that you take this very seriously. So what is it people are taking seriously? I think that they're trying to define the current legislature's package of reform agendas as more than a series of initiatives, but rather as a comprehensive view of what the good society is or what the public interest is, which is different from the one that people are bringing to the fore at Moral Mondays. The difference is about equality, about opportunity, about the relation between the obligation to look out for the least or the weakest and the wish to provide opportunity for the most able. It's a different view about what we owe one another and what we're trying to achieve. And whichever side you come down on, I think there's a lot to be said for making those stakes clear.
How do you feel about that, Becky, what's going on? I mean, given what you just said, the idea that there should be public discourse, how do you feel about what's going on Mondays at the legislature?
I think there should be public discourse. I think that, anytime anybody has a disagreement, I work for a think tank. We think ideas and debate and discussion are a good thing. We think that moves all of us forward. So I think that they are, I think they're doing, speaking their mind, exercising democracy. I do question lawlessness when it crosses over that line. The other thing is, just to Jed's point, I've been a little confused of exactly what they want. Exactly what are they protesting? And it does seem to be a broader kind of philosophical stand. There are some issues that I think are very important at the General Assembly. Eugenics compensation is one that we've written a lot about at my organization. Corporate welfare, when you talk about the distribution of money and tax money and how that's spent. Those are areas where I feel like they could have a direct impact on something rather than just kind of saying, we don't like what the Republicans are doing.
All right. Well, I appreciate this. I'm out of time. I think I said, I gave the commission member was Vikram Rao. So whatever it was I said, let me tell you, for the record, Vikram Rao was on this program from the Mining Commission. And I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Becky Gray, Vice President for Outreach, John Locke Foundation, Duke Law Professor Jed Purdy, News and Observer political reporter Rob Christensen. Thanks very much. Good to have you on the
show. Thank you.
Thanks a ton, Frank.
And coming up, the winner of the R State Magazine Songwriting Contest. Stay tuned.